a quotation from Francis Crick, who was with Watson, the discovery of the double helix, right? Okay, this is from, he won the Nobel Prize in 1962 in physiology and medicine. And in 1978, he made this statement: no newborn infant should be declared human until it has passed tests regarding its genetic endowment. And if it fails these tests, it forfeits the right to live.
Oh, my God. Wow,
Francis Crick.
Wow.
He did the double
helix
DNA thing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He won the Nobel Prize.
So did they use that method to determine what he saw?
Well, yeah, it was, it became way earlier.
Yeah.
It became, regular practice.
Well, I mean, when you think about, babies being born in the 19th century, early 20th century, they didn't even have the medical capacity to try to save, babies with severe problems. So, what do? You let the babies die because there was no concept of a possible future for them.
Well, and they were going to pollute the,
and they
the
were going to pollute
pool.
The gene pool also, but even besides that, I mean, even people
nation of people with Down syndrome, which I think would probably be a great based on my relationships with. Okay, so what we wanted to talk about, and Crick, kind of brings us to this subject, are current manifestations, and this is not my favorite thing to do, to research this stuff and come back to it over and over again. But I have felt for a long time, listening to the news and reading stuff and just seeing that renamed eugenics thing in the thinking. I mean, you go in the back of the Harvard Magazine and dating services are called good genes, right? That's minor compared to, one of the things that happened at Fernald before I got there, but not too long, in 1946 through 1953, MIT, Harvard, the AEC, the American Energy Commission, the Atomic Energy Commission, Fernald doctors and Quaker Oats collaborated in an experiment that was used in what was called BD, boys' dorm, still there when I was there. And these young men, kids really, who were so-called higher functioning, were told that they were going to be getting special food with vitamins in it. And, letters went out to their parents, if they had any, from the superintendent of Arnold saying, will you give permission for your son to get vitamin-enriched oatmeal? Okay, but really what they were putting in the oatmeal was radioactive calcium and traces of plutonium.
To kill them?
Yeah. Well, to experiment on the effects of that. And so you had MIT scientists, you had Harvard, you had the Atomic Energy Commission, and they would test these kids, they'd test their urine, their feces, their... however they tested them. And these boys, and the book about them as adults is called The State Boys' Rebellion.
Did they get disease? Did they die? Did they get ill?
Oh, yeah.
What were the results?
Yeah, a lot of them had cancer later and committed suicide and stuff like that. But what the staff at Fernald, probably who didn't know exactly what was happening but were told what to do and sprinkled stuff in their oatmeal, these kids got to participate in something called the Fernald Science Club, which was very enhancing. It was an honor, and part of how they rewarded them is that they took them to Red Sox games. So this practice wasn't exposed until 1994. It went from 1946 to 1953. a very current manifestation. And you remember the bell jar? I have a friend who was the dean of social work at Columbia at the time. And she would say, "For whom the bell curves." Wow. It was the bell curve, not the bell jar.
That's right,
the
bell
curve. All right? And very controversial about, you know, identifying people who were less fit and less smart and, you know, a menace, basically. So now this guy, and I heard this guy on the radio, it was probably in 2013. He was on Radio Boston. His name is Jason Richwine, and he wrote a dissertation for the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, where he posited that as a way to control immigration, you gave people IQ tests to see if they had anything off to offer of value coming into this country. And his research, apparently, convinced him that Hispanics, and you could fill in there, Jews, whatever, have lower IQs than whites. And he uses the words whites and Hispanics. And on the website that I looked at, and I called in, you know, and I said, this is eugenics, and the IQ tests were used at Ellis Island, and he said, they were not. And I thought, huh. You're an asshole. Anyway, I didn't say that on the radio, but anyhow, he was hired by the conservative think tank, the Heritage Foundation, to, you know, advance this idea and keep the scum of the earth out of our wonderful country. And
also surfaced he was, again with the children who were coming to our shores yeah. last year.
Yeah.
You know, where
yeah.
these kids from Latin America were being treated as monsters.
So the Heritage Foundation, you know, he was getting... Well, okay, the cover page of his dissertation, right, had all of the signatures of his advisors, you know, these hotshot professors and people at the Harvard Kennedy School, signing off on this, his presentation.
That's what amazed me the most about that guy, is that he had all the backing of people like that, you know, like Harvard.
Well, he, you know, he went a little, you know, he went a little far out for the Heritage Foundation, and he, you know, he was getting a lot of flack, and they wound up asking him to resign.
I mean, I thought that the IQ test, I mean, I taught in New York City, so, like, I was teaching in the ghetto, and the way I figured this out was someone said, the test would disprove him because if they said, here's a cup, and they give you A, B, C, which one does it relate to? A saucer, a coffee bean, or heat or something, you know. They, depending on their culture, they
right.
weren't related to a car
right.
because they lived in a house that couldn't
right.
afford saucers, so they just related it to heat.
The IQ test, you know, the
so
IQ tests haven't changed.
It was all cultural stuff
yeah.
being based on their measurements that they used.
Okay, and then a something else that, and something else that was used a great deal, and was used in Oklahoma at the University of Oklahoma to determine whether to, I'm trying to remember the euphemisms for, with, you know, withhold treatment from, let's say, a baby born with spina bifida, or Down syndrome, or you know maybe a crack addicted baby, you know, that so they had this formula to determine whether or not to withhold nutrition, okay? And, you know, the euphemisms are allowed to die when actually they're being killed, okay? And the formula is QL, quality of life, is equal to NE, natural endowment, times H plus S. And H represents what the family can contribute. I mean, how well can the family take care of a kid who's going to need, you know, help and care. And S is the amount of money that society would need to invest in the care of this child.
Sounds like the transplant candidacy list.
Right. Yeah. Okay, well, which is eugenics. I mean, our whole thing is, you know, you listen to the news, you read this stuff, and it's like, this is supposed to be a discredited science. It's not. It's got other names.
Well, I think I can I do a devil's advocate thing now?
Yeah, it depends on our... You're kidding me.
I have okay. to do this because otherwise we're leaving out some the reality stuff.
Okay, but we had a hard time deciding what to... fine, if you can...
Oh, go ahead.
I don't know what time it is.
Oh, it's 9:15.
Oh, okay. We have to end at 9 and...
We have to end
right,
at
ahead,
9.
Go ahead, go ahead.
Should I?
Yes, of course.
Okay.
Yes.
So I want to throw in this devil's advocate stuff because this has to do with why this pseudoscience is so was so appealing and still is, whatever name we call it, whether and because the issues raised by eugenics are exactly the same issues that are raised by genetic engineering, which is another reason it's so relevant today. So, and by the way, the Eugenics Record Office was closed in 1939.
Are you talking about the United States had a eugenics office?
Eugenics Record Office, yeah, at Cold Spring Harbor, which is one of the homes of genetic research.
And it's tons of data and records.
Tons of data and records, which had they had to be sued in the 1990s to get those records public. And they finally did. If you go to Cold Spring Harbor, you on their website, there's a huge thing about the eugenical research done there at the Eugenics Record Office.
Is there still but, an Eugenics Association? Because when you mentioned
I'm sorry, what?
Is there a Eugenics Association?
Not that I know of.
Freelancing? You know,
like, No. Eugenics, the Nazis killed eugenics as anything anyone could publicly espouse because they went so far over the edge. So, I mean, many people said eugenic, you know, the Nazis gave eugenics a bad name. What a shame.
So now it's just completely insidious and used under access to health care.
Right, exactly.
I mean, it's the same crap.
But I think to be, and really, I mean, I know this is going to sound, you know, questionable probably to you because, you know, who here is not a liberal at least, right? But the reasons this was so popular is because it addresses real problems in society. I mean,
well,
we can say
yes,
that's the
right,
devil's
right.
advocate
right.
part.
Yep, we agree with
so, that. You know, if you're talking about where do we invest medical resources? How many babies do we save if it means a comparable number of 50-year-olds with cancer will die, who could live if there were the resources? How many old people do we, I mean, this is an open debate now, how many medical dollars do we invest in keeping people alive at older ages? Like we will be facing, you know, okay. How does society deal with these issues if we're not willing to talk about them as real? How do we deal with them even if we are willing to talk about them?
Or
how
safety.
Do we deal, or safety,
yeah, right.
right,
all of
safety.
Us live in safe communities.
How do we deal with, you know, getting money for education in poor communities when we're voting Republicans into office? You know, how do we do that? How do we discuss the inhumanity inherent in eugenical policies and still look at real issues of resources in society? You know, that's where it gets very uncomfortable.
So maybe it's a product of our educational system, because those people who are out there voting for the Republicans aren't educated enough to know the difference.
It's not that it's very complex. It's about
there. Some of the anti-abortion thing and the sanctity of life from right wingers may have its basis in being anti-eugenics. I mean,
That's right.
There's a lot of complexity to it.
That's right. There's a lot of complexity to it.
I think it's important, too, to, you know, I recognize it in, for instance, you know, in Rwanda with the, you know, the slaughter of the Tutsis. And ethnic cleansing, okay? So it is about caring for vulnerable, you know, babies and people, but it's extremely widespread. And, you know, part of the rationalization for that slaughter was, well, it was politically orchestrated by the president at the time. But it also had to do with the different traits, okay? Because typically the Tutsi were more nihilistic. They were, you know, they had, you know, less, they had, you know, like sort of longer heads and, you know, considered to have finer features. Now there's, you know, there's an element in that genocide of colonialism. Mm. And you know, and in, you know, in Kosovo, and, you know, ethnic cleansing anywhere, okay, I think has a conscious or unconscious, which can be more powerful than a conscious idea. A conscious idea that it's a group. If we get rid of a group of people, you know, we're going to have fewer problems. Or it's a group of people who are causing our problems. So, you know, it's beyond, for me, it's beyond, you know, what babies get to live and which are allowed to die, which is a big part of it. But I think it's an infection, this stuff, this eugenics, because it is so seductive. I'm going to end. And let me tell you, wading through this stuff to try to kind of get to some, you know, real important details was tough. It's huge. Okay, so a very famous the case that was heard by Oliver Wendell Holmes was the state of Virginia sued to sterilize. Let me see what page this is. Ms. Carrie Buck. Okay, and this is from a book called *The Mismeasure of Man* by Stephen Jay Gould, and about IQ tests. And
great book.
Yeah, yep, really good. And he talks a lot about. Okay, this case was brought to the Supreme Court. And it was a decision that was made to allow this sterilization of Carrie Buck, who was a resident of the Virginia colony for epileptics and the feeble-minded. And this was in the 1920s.
The case was in 1927. It was in 1927 it went to the Supreme Court.
Oh, okay, good. I couldn't get an exact date. So anyway, Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote, quote, "We have seen more than once that the public welfare may call upon the best citizens for their lives. It would be strange if it could not call upon those who already sap the strength of the state for these lesser sacrifices." And I just want to add here that Carrie's mother, okay, was Emma Buck, also a resident of this institution. Carrie's daughter, she'd had a daughter named Vivian, okay? And Carrie's sister was Doris Buck, okay? It gets a little confusing. But so you have this, you know, three generations of this family living in this institution, okay? And so he says, it would be strange if not call upon those who already sap the strength of the state for these lesser sacrifices, getting sterilized.
three generations of imbeciles are enough, unquote. The judge was referring to Carrie, her mother Emma, and Carrie's daughter Vivian. Carrie was sterilized in 1927. Under the same Virginia law, her sister Doris was sterilized in 1928. Never having been informed of the nature of her surgery, and nobody was, you know, I said, you're going to go get your tonsils out, right? Never having been informed of the nature of her surgery, Doris later married, and she and her husband tried to have children. It was not until 1980 that Doris learned the cause of her infertility. And so Gould is writing about this, and he quotes her, Doris Buck's simple and eloquent testimony should stand for millions of deaths and disappointments, and to help us to remember that the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. And Doris said, I broke down and cried. My husband and me wanted children desperately. We were crazy about them. I never knew what they'd done to me. Now, one of the interesting things, I mean, an amazing thing about this is not only that it's Oliver Wendell Holmes, right? But at the Nuremberg trials of Nazi war criminals, you know, after the war, and we didn't even get into what they did with this, but at the trial, the defense attorney cited this decision by Holmes and said, you Americans who really perfected this, you know, eugenics thinking
and laws.
And law, and put it into laws, you know, now you're pointing at us. Where did we learn about this?
And it was truly
an important
us.
An important point.
Yeah. So who brought that denies the, you know, centuries of anti-Semitism and ways of they were practicing eugenics in other ways through policy.
Oh, and through genocide. I mean, through
right.
genocide.
They started in hospitals. They started in hospitals, giving lethal injections and starving.
What's now Namibia.
Huh?
They started in what's now Namibia in Southwest Africa.
Oh.
There was a German colony there, and the Germans wiped out, I think it was 80-something percent of the Herero people.
Yeah.
And it was their training ground for the genocide in World War II. And it had to do with fitness. So, and then they did research on offspring of Dutch residents in this colony with Herero woman, and tested the children, of course, all of whom were found to be inferior. And that was the beginning of this whole issue of miscegenation being the disaster. And then after, when Hitler came to power in Germany, took back the Rhineland, the area between France and Germany that had been ceded to France as a buffer zone after World War I, the disaster of World War I and the Versailles Treaty, one of the first sterilization acts of Germany, of Nazi Germany, was to sterilize the children of children of African soldiers and German women from the Rhineland. So that's when the Germans started practicing. But interestingly, the Germans could not get any eugenical law, outwardly eugenically based laws passed until Hitler came to power, because there was too much protest from the Lutheran Church.
Yeah, the Lutherans were the good guys.
Yeah. So it really was. And then once the Americans and the German eugenicists started working together, and then Rockefeller was funding, you know, as I think
and
I
who,
said, the German Institute.
Who went over and spoke?
Who?
Laughlin from the
Laughlin went over.
He went over and talked
oh,
to the
yeah.
Germans about
he was given an honorary doctorate from Heidelberg University. 1936. Comes up too, like people, you know, if I'm Jewish, they still want to know where our horns are and all kinds. Mm-hmm. You could just drop a word. You can put it in People magazine. You could read it at the supermarket, whatever they say, and people believe that stuff. And that's even far beyond the fact that you have these intellectuals supposedly doing scientific studies and making up all this garbage. So you just say something, and all of a sudden, it's the truth.
Right.
That stinks.
Right.
Is it question and answer time?
Yeah. Yes.
Where does phrenology fit into all this?
Oh, phrenology is my favorite.
If anybody wants to see this, this was the New York Times. I couldn't get a copy, but Susan sent it to me. It's from 2014, and it's about...
I probably was supposed to print that out.
No. It's about, you know, eugenics and racism and the opening of the records of the Eugenics Record Office.
Right.
So if you want to...
So, phrenology. Well, phrenology was interesting for so many reasons, but one is that it was kind of a positive and... relatively benign manifestation of all these kinds of pseudoscientific theories.
So eugenics came first and then phrenology?
Yes, eugenics came first, but phrenologists were starting to, I mean, they had skull readers and face readers back.
Is this like seances or that?
No, phrenologists were people who, they were skull readers.
They want to see who can commit crimes. They're doing studies of facial structure.
Well, what's fascinating about phrenology is some of the findings. I mean, what the phrenologists did was they mapped the skull. They mapped the skull and face to show areas that were characteristic of certain traits. So, like, for instance, I have a very large bulge back here.
Uh-oh.
And I had...
Uh-oh.
And in phrenology, what that means, when women have this large part of their skull, it means, it signifies love for children and small animals. You'll notice in 19...
Yes.
So,
my dog.
Phrenologists really believed that eugenicists didn't, they believed that these horrible traits like pauperism and alcoholism and all those others we've been talking about were fixed, that you could not change in any way if you were an alcoholic, whatever, promiscuous. But phrenologists believe that you could change, to the point where in some of the institutions Wendy was talking about, meant what were really, in a lot of cases, mental hospitals, under benign directorships, they use these things called phrenological helmets. So they actually form these
helmets. Change the shape of your head and then you'd be different?
Yes.
Hey, cool.
Exactly. And if you changed your... If you were able to work on yourself, if you spent time in nature, if you studied, if you, you know, were conscious about what kind of work you did... They believed that you could change your character and actually the shape of your skull would change.
Wow.
Did they...
So it was rather positive.
Did they measure and...
They didn't measure. They tried to correlate. And a lot of this was done... When did phrenology, I think, also started in the late 1700s. And they were looking... It started with investigation into criminals, looking at... Trying to find... Like, you know, if there were certain parts of the skull that were similar in murderers, for instance. Yeah. So they were looking for skull shape of murderers. And they thought if they could find that, they could determine who would be prone to be a murderer. And that if they found that, they could even perhaps help people change that. And because they had this outward sign that they could track. So this really goes back to this Enlightenment idea that what's inside shows on the outside. what's really fascinating, there was a renewal of interest in phrenology in the 90s, because it was seeming that from a lot of the brain, the neurological research that was being done, some of the things that we're finding completely correlated to the areas of the head that the phrenologist had found, you know, certain traits in. I mean, some of that is a really obvious example is, you know, high foreheads are supposed to correlate with intelligence. So, you know, I mean, when I was growing up, people said, oh, good, you have a high forehead, you know. Now, these were not phrenologists, but, you know, if, you know, on a very simplistic level, that was phrenology getting into the general culture.
Right, they read time.
That's not one of the things that correlates to brain research, by the way, but there were, and I'm not going to remember from the 90s what they were, but it was really quite fascinating that they were looking back on this history because of the level of study that was done to try to correlate these areas with certain characteristics. It was actually some of it that ended up being somewhat, not, I wouldn't say credible, but amazingly congruent with what was coming out in neurological research. The other thing about phrenology, or other things about phrenology, is that was a very close association between phrenology and fine art in America. 19th century sculpture, you can look at a lot of is phrenological sculpture. You know all those statues of lovely women that there's one in the courtyard of the Cape Ann Museum of this woman, you know, she's like this. And her
like
head...
The Greek classic.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. Her hairdo is a bun down here. That's to exacerbate this lump I talked about.
Exaggerate.
Right. Yes, not exacerbate, thank you. Exaggerate this. And what that meant, if you were looking for a mate, was that the woman would be a good mother. So people dressed in certain ways.
But this impulse has been with us forever, huh?
Yeah, right, exactly. It's inherent. We want to understand. We want to make sense of our existence and figure out how to have the best kind of society.
I just have a question for you, Susan. When you were copying this thing, and, you know, there's one guy up there who has some hair.
He's the Greek statue.
Did you find out anything about why he gave the Greek hair and everybody else is like...
No, well. I didn't. And I also didn't find out why heads that have eyeballs are the Caucasian and the monkey. I mean, what was he saying about that? You know, the Mongolian and the Negro and the Greek statue, even the ideal doesn't have eyeballs.
Well, it's most like the statuary that doesn't.
No, they actually do have eyeballs.
Well, a lot of times you just see it like that.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, but that's because they don't have the paint on them anymore. I mean, these were colored, they actually are carved in.
Listening to the Diane Rehm show the other day, and was a bunch of very interesting people talking about Baltimore and what's been happening there, and and talking about what are the causes, and I kept thinking you got to go deeper. It's not simply that people of color have been segregated and their communities bifurcated by highways and, they're far away from any kind of jobs and far away from, any kind of contact with the larger community. It's not just, what were people believing? You know, what was the belief system that led to congregate and segregated housing and lots of other things? And I think until you get down to what were people thinking? I mean, what were they believing when these, social structures, segregated housing, et cetera,
acid prisons.
I mean,
I think, you know, you got to get down to the level of belief to begin to rethink, you know, doing it better. And this idea that eugenics is a discredited science is, it's, no.
It should be. It's a discredited science, but it's not, but it's a belief system that exists.
Yeah, and it's unconscious. It's very deeply unconscious. And then just one other thing, I, member of the congregation at the Gloucester Universalist, whose name is Brenda, and probably a lot of you know her, you know, had a lot of struggles in her childhood. She, you know, she had certainly PTSD from, you know, a very abusive mother, some, you know, social challenges, developmental challenges, heart of gold, had two kids, and when her youngest kid, Brittany, was ready to go to Fuller, to kindergarten, she took Brittany over to Fuller, where she had gone to school, and I don't know if it was the principal, and this is years ago, okay, I don't know if it was the principal or one of the teachers who said, oh, Brittany has to be in special classes, she because her mother has special needs, right?
Wow.
And that is this unconscious, you know, well, you know, she's inherited this. And God bless her. I mean, this is such a great story. Brenda, who was very connected with child development when it was on Maplewood Avenue, before it was Pathways, you know, she had had her kid over there, you know, Head Start, all this stuff, and had great relationships with people. She went over there, and the staff there helped her write a letter to Fuller saying, basically, how dare you? And it was one of the stories from 23 years of ministry that is, you know, lodged in my heart. And it's about belief in eugenics.
Right. In those inherited traits.
I just, I have the, two things. One is that I'm having a little bit of a brain lapse here of, like, what was the connection when years ago they used to photograph students nude? What was that? I mean, I'm just not remembering.
That was eugenics.
It was eugenics.
It was,
but this is like
Harvard,
in, like, this
50,
generation.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
50s, 60s. Harvard
did photograph the, yeah,
yes.
I know
Hillary Clinton, right? No, Harvard was looking at body type, and it was eugenics. That's what it was. That's what it was.
Really recent.
That's really recent. And eugenical research at Harvard was, what, through the 60s, maybe even later? I mean, we talked about this guy's dissertation being signed off by Harvard professors.
Yeah, and there's Scott Davis so there. I know he
yeah.
a lot about that stuff. Right. Yeah.
So what Harvard. Are they actually looking for? White Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, you know, that's the really they wanted? Aryan.
Well, it isn't that they were looking for that. It's that they were looking at body type and seeing how it correlated to certain kinds of people, shall we say. You know, I mean...
In my book, which is a bestseller that I wrote called Grace Notes. It's,
oh,
you've seen it, you know.
It's
10
here.
Weeks on the New York Times. Yeah, no. The first section is about Fernald, and the first story in there is about, it's called Rita, not her real name, and it's about my experience taking her, because she had a weird syndrome, from the ward at Fernald to Harvard Medical School for grand rounds. And the experience of that, you know, very kind of detoxified. Everybody was really nice, but they poked and prodded at her in a Johnny in front of, you know, all these male medical students, and revealed parts of her body to be studied. And I was standing there, observing this. And this is a person who was a real person. I mean,
yeah.
Just with a personality. And
Rita felt it, didn't she?
Oh, yeah.
Of course.
She got it.
She had to.
I just think this is such an unbelievably relevant topic when we're on the verge of genetic engineering to the degree that we are.
Mm. Yes.
It's truly terrifying.
It is. Mm-hmm. It is.
Yeah. So it to is. Look at the recent history, it makes me even more frightened.
When I was in North Carolina, I had, I got pregnant by the boyfriend I was living with, and we decided we didn't want it. So I went to the Baptist Hospital, and they asked me to go see a psychologist, and he said, I'm going to ask you for a psychiatric reason why you don't want the baby. And so I gave him an answer, and he said, oh, that's sociological. And I gave him another answer, and until that's good. And he wrote down the one that would pass me, because then you need a psychological right. reason to have an abortion in North Carolina, but it happened to be the Baptist Hospital. So I ended up in this four-person room, and then I had the abortion. I stayed overnight, and then the nurse came in the next morning. She took me down the hallway to look at the bassinets. So I looked, and I think she was trying to change my heart. You know? And I just looked at someone else's babies, and I went ahead with it. In the room was a girl in the next bed. She was 16 years old, got pregnant. She was black by her boyfriend. And all the families came and visited them. The reason the baby died, it had water encephalitis or something.
Hydrocephaly.
The next bed, another woman, I think she was black too, she had a normal baby. And then the one opposite me, the fourth bed, she was mentally retarded. She had a mentally retarded child. She got pregnant with her mentally retarded boyfriend, and probably to them had another mentally retarded child. So they gave her, I heard that she had been fertile, what do you call it?
Sterilized.
I could have said something. I could have gone to the government. I could have reported what I heard. I didn't do anything.
I signed up for this thing that my stepson told me about. It was called 23andMe, where you send them some saliva and they look at your DNA and they tell you a lot about yourself. And Jesse, my son, told me about this because he had done it, and he said, I'm 2.4 Neanderthal.
Which is good now.
I thought they were dead. I thought we killed them all. And he said no. So I sent my spit in, and I'm 2.8 Neanderthal.
I knew it.
And the thing about Hitler, I mean, this is what's amazing about it, is the Northern Europeans have more Neanderthal than anybody else does.
Really?
Yeah, not the Asians, not the Africans, but
oh, what does us. That mean?
It means that Hitler was fucked up.
Oh, totally.
But also, there's lots of studies about Neanderthals now, and they're not quite as ugly as we picture them. They're not as
Let's
stupid.
See, where are
and, you know.
But behind Wendy.
And they have. They, you know, they decorated themselves, and when somebody died, they made a big deal out of it.
Yeah,
and
they've been re.
Yeah.
What is the word? Rehabilitated.
Right.
Well, they always were. Apparently, we've given them a bad.
Yeah, you use that word like imbecile and moron.
Exactly.
Mm. They were
exactly.
cavemen.
Yeah. Yeah. And now they're thinking that. Now humanoids and Neanderthals interbred quite
oh,
a bit.
Oh, yeah, they did. We did.
Or, I mean, Homo sapiens and Neanderthals.
Yeah, Homo sapiens and Neanderthals.
Humanoids.
Not eugenically correct.
Yeah. No, terribly incorrect. Terribly.
Wasn't most of this eugenic stuff, it goes way back to just how people of power held on to the concepts of slavery and undermining anybody else.
Oh, of course.
And that's why it's still strong today, because
right.
the same power has to keep the same shit going.
The war, on drugs is a eugenic
never get sick.
Program.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. I think it's kind of interesting about that, because eugenics puts it into the scientific realm. And in fact, it's racism.
You cook
yeah.
the
books. You know,
just
I mean,
like
in fact, that's what it is in our lives. You know, it's like...
So it's rationalizing
I can
racism.
Download it again. Share it with your... You know, uplifting reading.
Uplifting thing. I actually just read this, just talking about racism, just this amazing book called Just Mercy, which is about the prison system in the South and about how blacks have been imprisoned for so long by this guy who has worked in trying to get black prisoners off death row and children off death row. But it is the most insidious, heartbreaking system. That is just how anybody, you know, it's like it's a background in eugenics that makes something like that even possible.
Mm-hmm. Right,
that's what it is. Mm-hmm. Like it okays it somehow.
Yeah.
And it's that's terrifying to me. More terrifying than like kind of the scientific research as if this is fact. It's like it's just going ahead, you know, bulldozing ahead,
right,
as if it's acceptable.
It's
like
way
part of the culture. It's no longer
just
about. Yeah, and
it's so systematized that you don't even question it.
I think we should publish this whole presentation, discussion, everything in the New York Times Magazine section. Where is eugenics today?
It will be on
the
Posture Writers Center website as a podcast.
That sounds good enough to me.
She's just going to
thank you.
You just have to look it up.
It'll be on
the snack.